For those of you who may be new, I see a few new faces. If you don't happen to have them with you, there's some Bibles against the wall, which you may find helpful to have one for Bible study. I'm always amused by people who don't think a Bible is important to have with you for Bible study. It happens a lot. People call me up when I have classes. They set up for it. Say, do I need to bring a Bible with me? Only if you want to. As we're waiting for a few more to drift in, I'll just say for the benefit of those of you who are new, welcome. My name is Wes Howard Brook. This is the fourth of our five sessions on John's Gospel this week. I hope that by coming in the middle, you don't find yourselves too lost and confused. If you are, as we go along, feel free to jump in and ask questions is one option. Another is to talk to me or perhaps some of the other folks who've been part of this week afterwards. And another option is that I understand the tapes of what we've done earlier this week are on file due to the miracle of the tape ministry around here. So inevitably you are coming in a little bit in the middle, but hopefully that won't leave you too much adrift from what's gone before. So we'll just take a moment of quiet and have a brief opening prayer, and then we'll begin this morning. Creator God, we thank you for gathering us together on this beautiful morning. We thank you for all the energy and spirit that's present in Holden Village and all the activities and all the work that goes on behind the scenes to make the life of the community here possible. We ask you to keep our hearts and our eyes open this morning as we consider what it means to become children of God, and that we allow ourselves to hear with fresh ears and to see with fresh eyes what it means to be followers in your way. And we ask this through our friend and brother Jesus and the Spirit who is always present in our midst. Amen. Well, good to see so many people here on this beautiful day. I said to others, I'm not sure I'd be in here this beautiful sunny day. It was the other way around, so appreciate your dedication to something. For those of you who haven't been here, and just to refresh for those of you who have, what we've done during the week is to look at how John's Gospel acts out and speaks out the challenge that's at the center of the prologue, the challenge in chapter 1, verses 12 and 13, to receive authority to become children of God. And as we've looked at in our first three sessions, we've looked at the three nots that's in contrast with. On Monday, we looked at what it means to not be born of blood. On Tuesday, we looked at what it means not to be born of the will of flesh. And on Wednesday, we looked at what it means to not be born of the will of man. Today, we'll look at the other side of the pendulum, directly at what it means to be children of God. And to do that, we'll look at John's Gospel, chapter 9. As I mentioned on the first day, a lot of John's Gospel, in fact, I would argue and have in some of my own work, that all of John's Gospel is structured around a pattern known in Greek as chiasm, from the Greek letter chi, X. And that form briefly consists of verses that are shaped in parallel with each other, so you have a concentric pattern. The normal one is like A, B, C, B prime, A prime, so that the C part in the middle is the center of a given passage. There are three places in John's Gospel where that chiasm forms seven parts, A, B, C, D, and then back down C, B, A. One is the prologue, one is Jesus' trial before Pilate, and the third is the passage we'll look at today, the story of the person born blind in chapter 9. And I have those verses set out on the board to help us follow as we go through, that the beginning is verses 1 through 4, which is a scene of Jesus and his disciples, and that's matched at the end with verses 39 to 41 of Jesus and the Pharisees who were with him. We'll look, obviously, what that phrase, with him, means. The B parts are verses 5 through 7, Jesus and the one born blind, and 35 through 38 is the same pair of discussion partners, Jesus and the one born blind. The first C part is verses 8 through 17, the first set of challenges to the person born blind once that person is healed, consisting of the neighbors, the challenges from the neighbors and Pharisees. And the parallels, verses 24 through 34, the one born blind and opponents who are simply characterized as them. And at the center of the story, verses 18 to 23, is the confrontation between the parents and those whom the gospel calls the Judeans. What is often translated in your Bibles as the Jews, but for reasons we've discussed, and we won't get a chance to get into today, I'll be referring to as the Judeans. So that's the structure of our passage. And what the passage will be challenging us to see is the model of discipleship, according to John's gospel. What it means to accept the authority of being born children of God. To get a handle on it, we have to look at the context out of which it comes. I'm sure this is a story that most of us have heard many, many times, but we often hear it preached or read in church on special occasions, often during Lent, and out of the context of where it comes in the gospel, which is just after that powerful confrontation between Jesus and his opponents at Tabernacles in chapter 7 and 8. Try and imagine, if we can, especially for those of you who've been with us this week and remember some of the issues around the Tabernacles debate, what it would be like for the disciples at this point in the story. Jesus has stood up at the Feast of Tabernacles, that most holy of feasts that proclaims God's presence in the temple and the Torah, and claimed that he is the focus of God's activity. He is the light of the world. He is the one who gives water, living water, to the thirsty, not the temple. When the respondents objected, Jesus claimed that those who were the official leaders and those who identified with the official leaders, despite calling themselves children of Abraham, were in fact children of the devil, says in John 8:44. And finally, these people who are supposed to stand on behalf of the covenant of life, their last act at the end of chapter 8, is to pick up stones to hurl at Jesus, to try and kill him. And Jesus goes off and hides. Now, what do you think it would be like for the disciples, assuming they're even present at Tabernacles? There's nothing to say that they are. They're nowhere in conversation. Are they just hiding themselves? Did they stay in Galilee when their master went to Jerusalem? We don't know. But they're present now in the same location in Jerusalem, chapter 9, so they must have arrived there at some point. So perhaps we can at least assume that they were present to hear and see what Jesus did at Tabernacles. What do you think their attitude is right now toward the world around them, the world of the Judean leaders, the temple, the Torah? Everything they've been taught is good and holy and from God.
Confusion.
What else?
Fear,
disappointment. And their world has been turned completely upside down. I mean, imagine if we were told that all of our leaders, all the people we respect, are children of the devil. Told that by someone that we've chosen to follow. If we're told that all the holy places, all the places where we've come to trust, all our shrines, are empty shells, masking oppression and injustice, where would we turn? What would we imagine would be our next step? That's the context out of which this initial scene is set. Chapter 9. It says, as he was passing along, he saw, and the Greek is anthropon, blind from birth. Now, as we've said earlier, John's gospel rarely uses the Greek word for a male person, andros. It almost always uses the more generic term, anthropos, anthropon, for a human being. So there's nothing in the story that suggests that this is a man, although the pronouns throughout are he, but that's the default of the Greek language. They didn't have gender-inclusive pronouns any more than we do. But at the outset, the person is identified as anthropon, and note that it doesn't say the anthropon, a anthropon. The normal Greek form here would be ha anthropon, the or a person. It just simply says, they encountered Anthropon, blind from birth. Could easily be translated to humanity, blind from birth. Out of which the story focuses that state of being on one person, the symbolic of all of us. That's what these disciples are feeling, I think, at this point in the story. If we who inherit this tradition that tells us certain things about who God is, where God is present, who's in charge, are blind, then everyone must be blind. We're all blind. From the beginning, we're blind, from birth. One of those central images throughout the gospel. And they ask a question. Rabbi, who sinned, this person or this person's parents, to be born blind? Now, as I hope you've gotten the idea, this gospel is supposed to be funny. Think about the question for a minute. Who sinned, this person or this person's parents? How could this person have sinned to be born blind? What are the disciples thinking about here? Did the person think something bad in utero as a fetus? I mean, what's the nature of their question? How can someone be the cause of their own blind birth through their own sin? Does the question make any sense at all, at least that half of it? How many times have you heard that question, not stopped to think about what it is the disciples are asking here?
This is one of the passages the reincarnationists use.
Yeah, which is a concept, of course, completely foreign to the Hebrew mindset. The other half of the question makes perfect sense within the Old Testament mindset. Parents' sins cast on the children. The sins of the parents will be cast upon the children. So one half of their question makes sense within the dominant mindset, the way of flesh, in a sense, as we've heard it here, the prevailing ideology that the Judeans and all their teachers would have taught them. But the other half makes no sense at all. In either event, they're busy asking theological questions. And what's Jesus' response? Neither this one's sin nor this one's parents, but so that the works of God might be revealed in this case. We must work the works of the one who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. As one commentator put it, the disciples, like us in the face of radical evil and radical suffering, want to sit around and have theological discussions. Moralize about the victims, ask whose fault it is. That keeps us safely distant from being responsible for the solution. We can do all the analysis and figure out all the questions, and then sit back satisfied. Jesus turns it completely around and says, we, you and me, must work. Stop asking these questions about sin, stop trying to figure out whose fault it is, and do something about it. Now, I would suggest in our modern way of thinking about things, the issue at hand at the beginning of the story of rebirth and witnesses is the evil of the world, what we might call structural injustice in our modern way of saying things. Is that just something about the way the world is? Did we inherit it? Is it structural in that sense that it's just kind of been built up over time? Our ancestors, our parents made it this way? Or is it our fault? Should we be doing something about it? Can we change it? Is change possible? And Jesus says, we must work the works of the one who sent me while it is still day. And he immediately sets to work, and the disciples disappear from the scene, and not to be seen again until chapter 11. After he said these things, he spit on the ground and made clay with the saliva and put the clay upon the person's eyes and said, go, wash in the pool of Siloam, which means set forth. And the person went off and washed and came back seeing. Now, given what we've seen of John's gospel, or maybe it's your own thoughts, does any Hebrew scripture image come to mind in this idea of mixing saliva and clay, soil, to make clay?
Creation story.
Sure. Remember how God created human beings in the first place? Soil and spirit. Right? He took the soil and breathed on it. As it says in John's Gospel, chapter 7, When Jesus says, "Come to me, all of you who are thirsty, and I will give you living water," the narrator says he was speaking of the Spirit. For as yet there was no Spirit, because Jesus had not yet been glorified. The saliva from Jesus is living water, is the Spirit. This is a recreation, a new Genesis story, being born anew, again, from above. We have a new child of God right in front of our face here, and we'll see what happens with this one. Now let's look for a second at the command that comes with that. You note that the gift is given here, unasked for. This is not a person along the side of the road who's crying out for help. This is just someone who's there. So far, completely passive in the story. Jesus acts with no impetus from the person at all. We might say in theological terms, you know, the gift of grace is given unasked for. But there's a response required. To go and wash in the pool, which means sent forth. What do you think that might symbolize in the life of the Christian community? To go and wash in the pool. Sure. Baptism. We have here this complete Christian recreation. The person is given the gift of sight and asked to respond with baptism. And immediately is challenged, as we'll see. All the response that's required is to accept the call to be baptized, to wash in the pool which means sent forth, and sight comes, and with it, vision of what the world is really like, as well as what Jesus is really like. And those twin trajectories will follow us here on this road of discipleship in this story. As we go along, the person who can see now will learn through the task of challenging, being challenged and responding to that challenge, who Jesus is and what the world around the person is like. First, it's the neighbors who come. You notice the first challenge to someone who claims to see is, must not be the right person. Huh? This is the one who used to sit and beg, isn't it? Some said this is the one, and others said, no, it just looks like that person. That's the first challenge, mistaken identity. And the person responds with two powerful Greek words. I am in English. Anybody know what they might be in Greek? Someone knew in the first session. You know? And the Greek words ego eimi, which Jesus uses many times in this gospel in the context of his own I am. I am the light of the world. I am the true vine. I am the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am. It's John's gospel's version of the parables and the synoptics. Just like Jesus in Matthew says the reign of God is like so many different things. In John's gospel it says I am and doesn't have the word like. They're metaphors, not similes. I am, all those different things we just mentioned, allows us to try and imagine how God, how Jesus is like a vine, a shepherd, light, life. And here this person, blind from birth but now baptized, at least symbolically, claims these words. Where else do those words come from? Where did Jesus get those words? Where are the words ego eimi, I am, come from in Hebrew scripture? Anybody make a connection there?
Moses encountered with God.
Indeed. People hear that? The encounter between Moses and God at the burning bush. When Moses says, who should I say sent me? And God responds with the Hebrew that we sometimes pronounce Yahweh. I am the one who is. The best Greek way to translate that is I am, ego eimi. In the Hebrew version, or the Greek version of the Hebrew scriptures, the Septuagint, that's how the response is translated. Ego eimi. Just as Jesus claims the ability to speak, in a sense, God's name, so disciples are called to have that same authority, to become children of God. Theologians often like to say that John's Gospel contains what's called a high Christology, a sense of Jesus' oneness with God, this powerful sense of Jesus having come from God and going back to God. Jesus' humanity, in some people's version of it, is in the shadow, and his divinity shines forth. I would suggest that the extent that this gospel presents Jesus as one with God, it calls us to the identical relationship with God that Jesus has. Not any different at all. Just as this disciple here responds with ego e me, the same words that Jesus uses, I think it's challenging us, giving us a model that we are to say and do in the world exactly what Jesus said and did in the world. That point comes up a couple other times, and we won't get a chance to look at them all, but in the farewell discourses, the Last Supper discourse, Jesus says to his disciples, as the Father has sent me, so I send you. As I am in the world, so shall you be in the world. The works that I have done, you will do, and greater ones than I, you will do. There's nothing in John's gospel that presents the mission of discipleship as any different at all from Jesus' own mission. When we talked about this in our little Galilee Circle community, someone said, it's impossible. How could it be? And I think it doesn't take much reflection in our own lives to know that our own relationship with God isn't what Jesus appeared to be, but that's where we're called to be, at least according to this gospel. So this brand new disciple, the brand new person, first words out of this person's mouth are, ego eimi, I am. And they said to the person, how then were your eyes opened? And he said, the one called Jesus made clay and put it on my eyes and said to me, go to Siloam and wash. And I went and washed and could see. What does it appear that the mission of discipleship is about here? What's the person done?
Follow directions.
Follow directions, yeah, is one piece. And what else?
He told his story.
Yeah. Very simple, huh? Nothing elaborate. Nothing that requires a theological education. Nothing that requires any sophisticated skills. Say what God's done for you. Say it openly. Say it clearly. Say it straightforwardly. That'll get you in plenty of trouble. You know, you don't need to go out of your way, according to this gospel, to get yourself in trouble. You don't need to be a hero. Don't need to be sophisticated. Just say openly to whoever asks, this is what's happened to me. And what happens? They said to him, where is that person? He said, I don't know. And they led the once blind one to the Pharisees. Kind of a nasty thing to do, isn't it? The Pharisees. And the narrator adds, by the way, it was the Sabbath when Jesus made clay and opened the person's eyes. This time the Pharisees began to ask how the person could see. And the person said to them, he put clay on my eyes and I washed and I can see. Now they've heard it twice. Therefore some of the Pharisees began to say, this person cannot be from God because he doesn't keep the Sabbath. Others began to say, how can a person who is a sinner perform signs of this kind? And so they were divided. If you can't refute the identity of the person who was healed, then refute the capacity of the healer. Traditional way of doing things. So there was division. And they said to the blind person, what do you say about him? Given that he opened your eyes, the person said, he is a prophet. Little insight comes from the confrontation here, huh? In watching the Pharisees reveal their blindness, the person who's healed begins to see a little bit more about who Jesus is. The Judeans did not believe that he had been born blind and gained sight until they called the parents. Here we are at the center of the story. Isn't it interesting here that at the story which has Jesus at the beginning and the blind person all around it, at the center of the story, neither Jesus nor the blind person were present. In fact, incidentally, this is the longest passage in the Gospels, this story where Jesus isn't present at all. Not only are the disciples gone, Jesus is gone. This newly born disciple is all alone at this moment, facing the accusers, those who challenge. And at the center here are the parents. Now, given what we've already seen at the imagery of this story, what earlier images from Scripture might come to mind with this presence of the parents? Where have we heard of parents before? Sure. Parents is an interesting word in the Gospels. It's never used positively. Mother and father are separately are positive. Certainly God is father, and there are many positive image of positive images of mothers, Jesus' mother in particular. But parents as an entity are always in the Gospels in confrontation with children. Never is that word used in a positive way. Interesting. And here they are, called to testify. Is this your child who you say was born blind? Not even acknowledging, right? Who you say was born blind. How is it then that this one can see? In response, the parents said, "We know that this is our child and our child was born blind. But how it is that this one can see, we do not know. Or how the eyes were opened, we do not know. Ask this person himself. He is old enough and must speak for himself, for herself." What have the parents done here?
Abandoning the
responsibility.
Abandoned. Shifted responsibility. Why? The Gospel tells us explicitly. The parents said these things because they were afraid of the Judeans. For the Judeans had already come to an agreement that anyone who confessed him as Christ would be expelled from the synagogue. This is why the parents said, "This person is of age." Question the person yourself. Now, historically, this is completely out of context. That agreement didn't happen until around the time of the Gospel. During Jesus' lifetime, there certainly was no such agreement that we know of. This is projecting a couple of generations later back into the time of the story, the social reality that this community of John's Gospel, Johannine community, had to deal with. But some of the dark aspect of this story is that we cannot expect support from those who preceded us. On our own, because the people that preceded us are often invested in the way things were, rather than being open to the possibility of newness. I don't know if anybody's familiar with Thomas Kuhn's book, The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Might seem very far afield here. But Thomas Kuhn, a philosopher of science, argued that scientific changes don't come because people are persuaded to change their minds. Scientific change comes because the people who believe the way things were died, and a new generation that's taught differently grow up. The goal is therefore is that you're wasting your time to try and persuade people to change. Because for the most part, people don't change. But you can teach a new generation something different. So perhaps one of our most important inferences from that for our discipleship is what we teach our children is the most important aspect of what we do, rather than how we respond to those in authority, to those who are invested in the way things are. Or those who, like these simple parents, let's not treat them too hard, are scared for a good reason. What did we say earlier, for those of you who've been here? What would be the consequences of facing the Judeans and being excommunicated? Yeah. How so? And that's what the parents end up doing here. Shifting responsibility from themselves and saying, ask the child. Child's old enough of age. So a second time they called the one who had been blind and said, "Give glory to God. We know this one is a sinner." They know a lot, huh? In turn, the person responded, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I do not know. I know one thing. I was blind, and now I can see." Seeing more by the moment. You notice how the disciples and the Pharisees here have a common bond. They're all concerned with who's the sinner. And the person born blind isn't the slightest bit concerned with who's a sinner. Knows one thing. No, I was blind and now I can see. So much for moral theology. Therefore they said to the one, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" And the person responded, "I told you already and you wouldn't listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Don't tell me you want to be his disciples too." Glad you're starting to appreciate the humor here. Now you note an interesting irony of this passage. It's all about blindness and sight. The response here is in terms of listening and hearing. You're not listening. Not only can you not see, you can't hear either. Why do you want to hear it again? At this, they reviled him and said, "You were a disciple of that one. We are disciples of Moses." Just like being children of Abraham. "We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this one, we don't know where he is from." Which has its own ironies within the story, too. In answer, the person responded, "Now this is certainly an amazing thing. You do not know where he's from, but he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners, but if anyone reveres God and does God's will, God listens to that one. From of old times, it has never been heard of that anyone opened the eyes of one born blind. If this person were not from God, he could do nothing at all." Pretty good insight this person started to develop, huh? You notice the pattern of what's happening. He starts with the given premise of the dominant culture, the way of the flesh, as we've seen. We know that God does not listen to sinners. Now, we start, is that a premise we would start from? Isn't that interesting? That's a particularly interesting premise, given how many of the Psalms speak of a speaker who proclaims him or herself a sinner and cries out to God. But the official ideology of Judea here is that God doesn't listen to sinners. Isn't that interesting? So the person born blind does start from the dominant culture's perspective, contrary to the biblical perspective, but comes up with another piece of it. But if anyone reveres God and does God's will, God listens to that one. But confronts the official ideology with his own experience. That, I think, is the challenge of discipleship here, the challenge of this Johannine community is, what do we do when the things that we were taught conflict with our own experience? Do we deny our experience and say, that must not have happened to me? I must be crazy? I must be wrong? Or do we allow our own experience and what we've been taught to come into a little bit of creative conflict and lead us to new insights? Maybe what we were taught is wrong. Maybe God does listen to sinners. Maybe being born blind doesn't mean you're not a sinner. Have we ever had the experience of having something happen to us that was in conflict with the religious truths we were taught or some other truths that we were taught? Anybody ever had that experience? Anybody have something they might share of how that happened to you? Of something that you experienced that was different than what you were taught? Does everything just follow the way you were taught all your life?
In the meditation I shared this morning, I talked about how does it feel to be out of control for the first time in your life, and you wake up, and no matter what you do, it's going to go wrong. You have no place to go. And that's that empty void that you say, I'm completely vulnerable. I don't know how else to explain it, but it's a very painful period to go through. But that's when the grace of God comes into that emptiness some way. How do we confront that? When I lost a job a couple of years ago, it was a very painful thing, and I couldn't do a thing about it. Or we lost a loved one. When you've always been in control, and I just wonder if the Judeans have always been on top of things. Always in control, for the first time you realize, hey, we have no place to go from here. We're confused.
I'm not sure who it was that sinned, whether it was my parents or my old Sunday school teachers. I don't know, but it was always my impression that you could never really be honest with God. You could never be angry with him, question him, curse the day he was born. I mean, you just never did that. And I think down the road somewhere, I began to appreciate my own experience and the encouragement of others as well as the Psalms that reflect you can be very honest and brutal with God, with your feelings, with your pain, with your hurt, your death.
Growing up, I was told that if you don't use the gifts that God has given to you, he will take them away. And somehow in scriptures you find in Romans 11:29 that God's gift and call are irrevocable.
Thanks. And I'm sure for those of us who haven't chosen to share today, I'm sure at some level we've all had that experience. And I think often our response is to deny our own experience. You know, what we've been taught is so deeply ingrained in us. We so much trust our parents to be right. We so much trust the church to be right, at least when we're younger. We so much trust the government to be right, whatever our authorities are, that we must be the ones that are wrong in the face of the power of the elders. Whoever the elders are in that sense. I don't certainly don't mean that to slight people who are older. I don't mean just people who are chronologically older, but the people who are in charge, the authorities.
Yeah. I think probably for me the biggest one was the interpretation of the fear of God in terms of being afraid rather than in honoring because of God's loving grace. And somewhere in your life that's got to get turned around. You've got to get out from under being afraid. And that changes the whole perspective on why you do what you do.
Indeed.
Yeah, we still continue to do it generation after generation to keep people in line.
Yeah, I think it's amazing too how many of these attitudes 2,000 years later are that we would laugh at in a way are still so there. How many times have we heard people say that people must have AIDS because they're sinful? Or things like that. Or other bad things happen to them. We know the book Why Bad Things Happen to Good People and other books are trying to address that question because we know in our experience that bad things do happen to good people. It must not just be there's some secret bad thing about them we didn't know. But the need for those books is because most of us carry something with us that says, if something bad happens to you, it must be your fault. Must be God punishing you somehow. And that's certainly what the attitude was here. We're going to see in a moment here, in the next sentence, let us say it, in response to this person's little theological insight and speech and answer, they said to him, you were born completely in sin, and you were teaching us, and they threw him out. That's the other piece of it too, isn't it? How often the truth of it comes from people that we completely reject their ability to be in a position to speak truth because of who they are. If nothing is clearer to these people, this person was born in sin. They know the answer. They agree with the disciples, isn't it? The disciples start off at the beginning. This person, whose fault was it? Whose sin was it? They assume this person was born in sin. They argue about whose sin it was, but the presumption is the same. And one of the inferences of that presumption is, don't listen to that person. Boy, if we stop listening to people that were sinful, we'd be in big trouble. We have to just sit in silence all the time. How often do we have that experience of someone from the margins claiming a truth that comes out of their own experience that we reject because of who the messenger is?
We're dealing here with the Judeans in your terminology. Now, would this group that is doing the questioning and everything else be average citizens of the street in your understanding, or is this a special perfunctory of the synagogue?
Doesn't say.
I know, that's why I'm wondering.
Yeah, and I think we can't answer if it doesn't tell us. You know, one of the ways that people have tried to deal with the apparent anti-Semitism of reading this as Jews, to say it can't be all the Jews, it must be just the leaders. But interestingly, it doesn't say the leaders. And the gospel is certainly capable of talking about the leaders. It says that Nicodemus is one of the rulers. It uses the word archon for rulers several times in referring to the leaders. That's why I, in my what I said earlier during the week about Judeans, not being able to write it off as the leaders. I think it's anybody who identifies with the dominant culture. It doesn't matter whether it's the leaders or just people in the neighborhood who say so. You know, whatever you thought of my Vespers service, those of you here a couple nights ago, someone came up to me afterwards, angry that I'd said a bad thing about Boeing. Person wasn't a leader of Boeing, he was a retiree from Boeing. As completely identified with Boeing as the chairman. And that's been my experience of the relationship with people I know from Boeing. You don't have to be someone who makes $1 million a year. You can be an electrician on the line, someone who's making, you know, a simple labor living and just feeding your family at Boeing. And Boeing is as sacred as the church, if not more so. A word against Boeing is a word against you, because you're identified with it. So I think in this context, it doesn't matter whether it's the leader or not, any more than it matters whether it was the president of Boeing or just anyone who worked there. Once we identify with a system or a way of looking at things, that's who we are. I know an awful lot of Catholics, that's my tradition for those of you who haven't heard me share that, who would be much more zealous of Catholic dogma than the Pope would be. Or the, you know, the bishops often have a certain perspective, you know, from living it day in and day out. But an awful lot of conservative Catholics will be much more dogmatic, much more restrictive in their thinking, have much more hostility toward non-Catholics than bishops who, you know, who are in ecumenical circles and travel and have a little bit of experience beyond their own world. So I don't think we can write this off as just the leaders. I think it's anybody who identifies with the way the dominant culture is. Need to move on just a little bit because there are a couple other passages here we want to get to. You know, also, by the way, when you said it was the Judeans, at this point, it's not the Judeans. It was the Judeans earlier. In verse 18 and 19, those who confront the parents. But here it's just them. And I would make a claim that that's ambiguous for a purpose. It does say a second time they call them in verse 24. Therefore, a second time they call the person, which would suggest it's the Pharisees, not the Judeans, in fact. But it could be the Judeans, except the Judeans didn't talk to the person born blind, they just talked to the parents. So we have to read carefully sometimes. So it could be the Pharisees, but I think this gospel purposely leaves it the question open. It's just the great them out there that we're often afraid of. The non-specific, you know, people who will judge us, who will condemn us. What will people think of me? Which people? Well, I don't know, them. All those people out there who are ready to judge me, who are ready to condemn me for being different, for saying something I'm not supposed to say, for claiming authority I'm not supposed to have. And it's not often who we're really afraid of. It's not anybody in particular, but just them. Some vague sense of there are people out there waiting to condemn me, waiting to make fun of me, waiting to poke holes in my argument, waiting to make a fool out of me for saying something I'm not supposed to say, for thinking things I'm not supposed to think. So I think the opposition has grown very specifically from the neighbors, those with whom we grow up and have daily business, to the Pharisees, the specifics of the leaders and the intellectual elite, to the Judeans, those in the culture around us, to the much more universal sense of just them that we may have to talk to. And finally, all those confrontations are over, and the person is thrown out. It's interesting, on the Greek, it's a very violent sort of term, threw out, cast out, expelled. It's what, in the synoptics, is the word that is done to demons. To expel demons, to throw them out. This person is a demon. Doesn't belong, you know, what's a demon? What does it mean to exorcise? The root word of the term exorcise is to throw out, to take something from where it doesn't belong and get rid of it. Sinners who dare to speak up and claim God's truth don't belong in here. Get rid of that person. Get them out of our space. Outside. Don't let them pollute us. We're a pure people in here. Get them out. Don't have to see them, don't have to hear them. Jesus, upon hearing that he'd thrown out this one, found him, or found the person. You note the sense of searching. God, Jesus looking for the person. It's not like the person is thrown in Jesus' lap. Jesus hears, again, another irony here, this gospel, this passage filled with images of sight and blindness, hearing again. Jesus hears the person was thrown at and finds the person. And on finding that one said, "Do you believe in the human one?" And the person responded, "Who is the human one, sir, that I may believe?" And Jesus said, "You have seen him. He is the one speaking with you." And the person said, "I do believe, Lord," and bowed down to worship him. The act of finding on the outside. This passage, just like the trial before Pilate, has a strong confrontation between what happens on the inside and what happens on the outside. In the trial before Pilate, I hope sometime you read it with an eye to some of this stuff, there's this oscillation between on the inside where Pilate is and on the outside where people are crying for Jesus to be crucified. Inside and outside is very important. It's also inside the community and outside the community. Inside the Judean world and outside the Judean world. And the very next passage, which you won't look at, of course, is the Good Shepherd, who's much about bringing in and going out, coming in and out the door. So the image of coming in and going out is very strong in this gospel. And Jesus is on the outside. What might that say to us about our relationship with our churches and our institutions, about where Jesus is found? This woman once said to me, "The only God you find in church is the one you bring in with you." So here's Jesus finding this person on the outside and asks him to make a deeper commitment. Baptism was the first commitment, and interestingly, the person was asked to go and wash in the pool, which means sent forth, apart from this question of specific belief in the way Jesus characterizes himself, human one, usually translated inappropriately as son of man. And there's nothing about it being man. It's oiaston anthropos, human one, son of humanity. And the person responds in faith. And Jesus has this nice little statement that leads up to a confrontation, which I think is one of the most misunderstood ones in the gospel. And Jesus said, "For this judgment I came into the world, that those not seeing might see, and those seeing might become blind." And the Pharisees who were with him heard these things, and they said to him, "We're not blind too, are we?" Often, the Bible studies that I do, I like to have people get up and act out this story, because it is such a wonderful drama. You know, scene changes from scene to scene, and you learn a lot by playing the parts and feeling the emotions that come from identifying with one of these parts. And I'll never forget when a group of Pharisees were sitting there watching in judgment, they thought, and hearing the statement of one of them said, "You're not talking to us, are you?" Just associated with someone overhearing like that. Again, it's hearing. The Pharisees heard these things. Now you know, it says, the Pharisees who are with him. What's going on here? Are the Pharisees on the inside or the outside? Who is this last confrontation with? Who are these people? Who do you think? What does it mean to be Pharisees who are with him? Have we seen a character before who might fall into this category?
Nicodemus.
Sure. Nicodemus and the "we" of whom, for whom he speaks. Pharisees who are with him. The people who want their cake and eat it too. To be with somebody in this gospel is to be committed to them. And one of the great ironies is when Jesus is on trial before the Judean leaders, before the chief priests, it says Peter was standing by the fire with them. The high priest servants and such. When Judas comes to arrest Jesus, and it says he came with the Roman soldiers and the temple police, and there was Jesus, and it says Judas was standing with them, with the Romans and the temple police. Who you're with, who you're standing with, is where your loyalty is. And these Pharisees are with Jesus, but they're still Pharisees. That's the problem. Jesus said to them, "If you were blind, you would have no sin. But now that you say, 'We see,' your sin remains." Those who are on the inside, no fault to them. You notice this is the only time Jesus talks about sin is at the very end. those who are clearly blind, who insist upon responding in the way they've been taught, who are not open to anything, no matter what, are not the sinners in this story. The sin lies with those who claim to see. The Pharisees who were with him. They're with him. They claim to see. But they're still Pharisees, so their sin remains. They're not willing to give it up, to let go of their status and their power. Again, that's the group for whom this gospel had the greatest social problem, because they were the ones that could have turned it all around. They're still the ones who could turn it all around. What would it be like if our religious and political leaders acted this way? It would turn everything around. It would put our churches on the side of the poor. It would put our leaders out in the streets. It would put us in confrontation with injustice and oppression and all those things. And it would, in a very simple way, allow us to testify to what God's doing. It would allow us to be open to the possibility that truth comes from places we don't expect it to come from. But that's the only time that Jesus talks about sin. It's for those who claim to see. Us. No fault in not claiming to be a Christian. If you're not called to follow Jesus, no problem there. But if you claim to be a follower of Jesus, then you better live like one. We're under the harsher judgment than those who don't see it at all, who don't know who Jesus is, who aren't interested at all. We are the ones who have made that commitment, and we better live according to it, according to this gospel. That's the breathing out in this gospel story. That's the call of discipleship, the exhalation in the great breathing in and out that is the Christian life. It's interesting because it follows a path that we might think is backwards. Don't we usually think that first we form community, first we form a church, and then we decide what to do? And this gospel presents it exactly the opposite. First you're sent forth in the world, and then when you're thrown out and reviled and persecuted and left on the outside, then you better find some people to gather and huddle around with and find strength and heal each other and support one another and give yourselves enough energy to go back and do it again. After this scene, Jesus talks about a shepherd, and he has a Lazarus story, and then eventually he has the longest almost monologue in the New Testament. 5 chapters in John's Gospel, we'll look at the beginning of it tomorrow, where Jesus tells his community gathered what their life together is supposed to be about. Apart from the world, what are they called to do? How should they treat each other? What should they do with one another? And that's the process. It's not first that we become church and then form a mission committee, form a social works committee. It's that we go out there in the world with what God's done to us, and when we're battered around, we try and find a few people that have had the same experience and say, can you help me? Can you support me? I'm feeling so alone out there. It's painful. It's hard. I need someone who's had the same experience to share this path with, or I can't do it anymore. I can't do it alone. I need you people and my brokenness and my vulnerability and my fear and my rejection. So tomorrow we'll look at the image that this gospel presents in chapter 13. What I would suggest is its third sacrament, if I can use a Catholic term there. This gospel has 3 sacraments. Baptism, which we looked at. Eucharist, which comes up in chapter 6. The challenge in this gospel's harsh language to munch my flesh, much different than Paul's language of eat my body, munch my flesh, and drink my blood, which I would suggest is the public commitment that you're a member of this Christian community. And then finally, this sacrament of foot washing, as I have done to you, do to one another. We'll look at that tomorrow, as the key to the community's life for one another. Once we've had this experience, once we've walked this little path of discipleship, of our having our eyes be opened, of how we give each other strength and support ourselves to go back out and do it again. So Any questions or responses? We still have a couple of minutes before the bell rings, so anything anybody else wants to share or thoughts about this passage? Just make some sense, or is this all kind of crazy?
I have some problems yet with with the statement of Jesus in this last part of the chapter. That those who do not see may see, but that those who see may become blind. What's the second part of that statement?
What do you think? What does anybody think, given what we've said so far? What does it mean that those who are seeing might become blind?
You need a word in there that those who think they see?
Could be. Isn't that where the disciples were at the beginning of the story? They thought they were seeing, and they became blind to enable them to be on this path. You know, at the beginning and the end of the story, the disciples are in the exact same position as the Pharisees who were with him. Talking about sin, asking questions about blindness. Not doing it. You need first to be disavowed of the notion that what you think you see is sight. First, it's John's Gospel's version of Paul's sense of you've got to die to be reborn. You got to become blind in order to see. If you claim to see from the beginning, not about Jesus, but about the world, these people certainly thought they were seeing. We know, they say several times, we know this, we know that. From Jesus' perspective, they're blind. From their perspective, you know, they're seeing things all too clearly. That would be my sense of it. Jerry?
My problem is that in our lives, it's not, in fact, that we either see or we're blind. The truth is, it's a dynamic living, and this guy who now sees, the truth is, he's going to have all kind of garbage he's got to get rid of. He is a Judean, and so is that with us. And so that it would be kind of neat if it was crossing the line, but it's a continual process of throwing out the blindness so that we can see.
Absolutely. And this chapter is obviously a schematic model of the path of discipleship. It's an idealized version of what happens, told in one little story here. And no doubt the community faced exactly the back and forth. You know, there they are, after all, after the resurrection. Where are they? They're behind locked doors for fear of the Judeans.
You know,
after everything, they're in the exact same position as the parents, for fear of the Judeans. They seem to have gone nowhere, hiding. And then in the end, they're back in Galilee. Peter's fishing at night. At night, of all things. Catching nothing, it says. Fishing at night, catching nothing. Until Jesus comes along once more. So certainly they had the same experience at your suggestion that we all have. It's a cyclic, spiral sort of pattern, and that's why we proclaim these stories over and over and over again. And from the 3rd century on, the church, this is one of the 3 scrutinies, you know, the passages that are read during Lent, for new converts. The Samaritan woman, the person born blind, and the story of Lazarus are told in the 3rd, 4th, and 5th weeks of Lent, since the 3rd century. And they're told partly for those who are adults interested in making the commitment, but obviously also for the rest of us who need to keep hearing it over and over and over again. But it's presenting it an idealized version of this is the way it should be. And you note also that the process of coming to deeper insight comes in the process of confrontation. For those of us who'd like to think that we can live our Christian life in the safety and security of our churches and our homes, we all remain at a stagnant level for the most part. It's by taking that out there. In the Vespers a couple nights ago, we heard that wonderful passage from Ruth Morrow Ginsburg about something about a place like Holden is we're forced to be with people we wouldn't otherwise be with. And we grow in the process of that. Because we tend to be around like-minded people and have our own ideas confirmed. And it's in the process of reaching out and being around people who don't agree with us, who are different than us, who have had different experiences, that we learn about ourselves and about God. And that's part of this community's experience. Samaritans, blind people, Greeks, women, all those kinds of people that weren't allowed in full humanity in the synagogue,